I hear people talking bad about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. Tonight I don't mind you switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in the fallen dying knee. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. You're running down my country, man. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Some squirrely guy who claims he just don't believe in fighting. And I wonder just how long the rest of us can count and be free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down my country horse, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down the way of life, I'm fighting in the fallen diabetes. If you don't love it, leave it. Let this song I'm singing be a warning. When you're running down my country, man, you're walking on the fighting side of me.
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. That's the name of this program here at WhiteResistanceRadio.com, with lots more news and views for our people. Of course, those are the European founding settler people of the Dominion of Canada, the United States of America, the Dominions of Australia, New Zealand, the Republic of South Africa, Rhodesia, and those of you who may be listening this morning in the European heartland. I'm going to continue my Dominion Day programming and celebration. The Dominion Day, that was Canada's national holiday, was yesterday, the 1st of July. We celebrated the 150th birthday of the country, and with a lot of people a little bit disillusioned with the way our European roots and ancestry is being betrayed at the highest levels by all political parties, as they cannot get rid of the European founding settler people. That's us. Fast enough to mass third world immigration. I'm going to play a little bit about the Dominion Day from a broadcast that was nice, Jim Rizzoli and Diane King were nice enough to carry for me. This is a recording I did last year.
Immigration Reform Committee. Well, I wanted to wish you a very happy Dominion Day. I know some people call it Canada Day, but I want to talk to you about why I still celebrate Dominion Day, and I still celebrate under the flag of the real Canada, the Red Ensign. In 1965, two revolutionary things occurred. One was that Canada's traditional flag, the Red Ensign, was replaced by the flag we have today. The present flag is a rather illogical flag, you know, with the two red bars, the red maple leaf, and the white background. And if you ask people what does it mean, well, they're kind of vague. The two red bars, we're told, stand for the oceans, the Atlantic and Pacific. Well, as one of my students years ago chimed in when I mentioned that, but Mr. Fromm, seas are blue. He's right. And the red of the maple leaf, while it's attractive, when the maple leaf is red, it's dying. Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about this flag. This is the Red Ensign. This was the flag of the traditional Canada, the real Canada, and it's so meaningful. look at the Union Jack up in the top left-hand corner. That stands for one of our main languages, English, the source of our legal and government traditions, the British parliamentary system. And it also contains the Christian cloth. Now, I know there are people who reject Christianity, but this country was based on Christianity, and the fact that we have a system that doesn't allow people to die in the streets or die of illness uncared for traces back to our Christian roots. These aren't Judaic roots, these aren't Muslim roots, these are Christian roots, and this is the real Canada. Then, of course, the red and the white, so passionate, a commitment to blood and to life and to thriving. And then the crest, so meaningful, I'm just ticking off the surface. There's the fleur-de-lis of the French people who form such an important part of Canada. There are the symbols of Scotland and Ireland and England. And then the three maple leaves, green, the sign of life. And that's important, life. We're a thriving country. And the maple leaves, well, the vast forest of our country. And the three joined in one. Have different interpretations. One say it's the original European settlers, because our founding people were European, our founding settler people. The second maple leaf would be the existing native people. And the third maple leaf would be all the people, mostly Europeans, who came later. This is the flag that emphasizes the European nature of this country. Our founding settler people were European. Well, in 1965, Lester B. Pearson was about to pull off a revolution, and that was to turn our backs on our traditional source of immigration, which was the British Isles and Europe, and throw the doors open to the Third World. The long-range plan was to be the replacement of the European founding settler people within a century. In fact, with the present mass immigration, 85% from the Third World, the European founding settler people will be replaced by 2050. By 2050, we will be a minority. And in order to facilitate that, Pearson changed the flag, because our present flag means virtually nothing. That flag was a reminder of our roots. But this is a European country. That's why I celebrate the Union Day. And I celebrate Radio. I'm on quite inside of me. Check it out. White Resistance Radio. I sign off with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Grill. This is Paul Prong of the Canada First Immigration Reform Committee, wishing you a very happy Dominion Day.
And back to our regular broadcast. Hope you enjoyed that. I want to read something that a good friend of mine, longtime comrade in arms, he's the chairman of the Committee of German Expellees, and his name is Christian Klein, a great leader. And if you're not very familiar with European history, and geez, I don't blame you, because you're not taught much in school, and the largely Jewish-controlled mass media is not going to tell you a whole lot about these folks. Did you know what the greatest mass expulsion or ethnic cleansing in human history was? By greatest, we mean numbers. Stumped on that one? If you had other guesses, you're probably wrong. The greatest ethnic cleansing in all of human history took place from 1944 to 1948. It was the mass expulsion of Germans from Eastern Europe. Probably 16 million. That's 1/6, almost three times the magic six figure. 16 million ethnic Germans expelled from Ostpreussen or East Prussia, from Pomerania, from the Sudetenland, from the German parts of the former northern Yugoslavia and western Romania, from Silesia and what's now Poland, and from parts of the Ukraine.
forced to flee for their lives. 16, that's 1/6 million Germans, expelled. 3 million murdered or died along the way. Bet you didn't see a docudrama about that recently, did you? Or a Hollyweird movie about the sufferings of some of those people? Any of them, they make great stories. I mean, they're great human interest stories, a story of massive injustice. Oh yeah, when you think of World War II war crimes, what do you think of? Well, you know, the kangaroo court at Nuremberg, or if you're really informed, the similar kangaroo court in Tokyo, where some of the Japanese leadership, like Prime Minister Hideki Tojo, were put on trial for doing the very things that some of the Allies did. But anyway, that's another story. What Christian Klein has done here is to remind us of the great contribution of Germans to to Canada. Now, an equally interesting piece could be written about the contribution of Germans to Germany. To the United States. In fact, as the United States became a nation, apparently, they were within one vote of German becoming the official language of the United States. The contribution of German settlers was immense. But anyway, to Canada. 150 years and more, the German contribution to Canada. What amounts to a German contribution to in the history of Canada is more visible when looking back into the early colonial days of the country rather than to our present time, when Germans were proportionally more numerous within the total population, as was the case in Ontario in the mid-1820s. When they made up as much as 70% of the overall inhabitants. You know, going through, this is me digressing, but going through school, I thought almost all the settlers of Ontario in those crucial, first 60 years of the 19th century were from England, Ireland, Scotland, and Wales, and a small smattering of French, native people, but not so. In the 1820s, 70% were Germans. Of those days, we are reminded by the settlements with the German names throughout Canada, the most numerous of which are found in along the Grand River region of southern Ontario, and which developed into the cities and towns like Berlin, Breslau, Mannheim, New Hamburger, Baden, Heidelberg, and Bamberg. Most of those names, of course, were changed during the First World War. The town of Berlin became Kitchener, and so on. Their origins go back to the pioneers who first had to cut the forests before they could put any seed into the ground. Much hardship was endured by the men, women, and children who came up from Pennsylvania around the year 1800, many of whom were German Mennonites who had earlier settled in the state. Another group that had come directly from Germany via Pennsylvania and New York State was led by the much talented Johann Albrecht Ulrich Moll, who had adopted the name William Bercy, which actually looks Hungarian. Well, actually it is Hungarian, although he was German. They started out from the Conestoga Valley in the United States and trekking on their own brand of Conestoga wagons brought the first herd of cattle with them. This group was enticed by then-Governor John Graves Simcoe of Upper Canada to come to his headquarters in Muddy York, which would become the city of Toronto, and he enticed them to start construction of what would become the city of Toronto. They also cut Yonge Street, which is the main north-south drag of that city, out of the bush and moved north to Markham, which was then called Mannheim, which they found, and that's a little bit to the north east of Toronto, and Markham today, once solidly European, is overwhelmingly Chinese. We've been invaded. My comments, not Christians. Back to his account. As we celebrate 150 years of Canada, we should recall that three of the fathers of Confederation were of German heritage. They were Charles Fisher, William Steeves, and Charles Tupper. The Confederation of 1867 in Charlottetown brought four provinces, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, Quebec, and Ontario, into the Dominion of Canada. It was a great political event, but not the birth of Canada, as pointed out by Kenneth Kidd, a former editor of the Toronto Sunday Star, in an article on December 28, 2016. Germans had made great contributions to this future Canada at a much earlier time. Philip Nout from Saxony came to Halifax in 1749 with German settlers on the ship Canning. He became wealthy and was the first German immigrant to later be elected to Parliament. A group of 300 more Germans, that would be to the probably to the Nova Scotia Parliament. A group of 300 more Germans came a year later on the good ship Anne and settled in part of Halifax, which became known as Dutch Village. Now, Dutch, of course, not because they're from the Netherlands, but Dutch as in Deutsch, which is the way a lot of people heard Deutsch as being Dutch. During the next 3 years, 2,000 more Germans arrived in Nova Scotia, of whom 1,453 soon left Halifax in May of 1753 to sail north southwest to Merlegouche Bay, where they founded the town of Lunenburg on the 7th of June, 1753. This town rose to prominence due to its fisheries and shipbuilding reputation, of which the ship Blue Nose, it's a schooner, is the most famous. In fact, the Blue Nose, made by Germans in Lunenburg, Nova Scotia, the Blue Nose became the symbol of Nova Scotia. In fact, Nova Scotians are often called Blue Nosers. And if you have a Canadian dime, 10-cent piece, the Blue Nose is on the back of the dime. The Queen's head is on the front, and on the back of the coin is the Blue Nose ship, the schooner. When in 1784 New Brunswick was separated from Nova Scotia, German Pennsylvania Germans, sometimes called Pennsylvania Dutch, that's as in Deutsch but not from Holland, founded the German town of Chipotle, Moncton, and Coverdale. The term German includes all people of German language and culture, regardless of their place of origin. Thus, immigrants from Austria, parts of Switzerland and France as well as from Eastern European regions have always been considered ethnic Germans. In Canada, from the early days, Germans were the third strongest ethnic group after the British and the French. In southwestern Ontario, there were 12,000 Germans listed in the census of 1848, of which 9,000 settled in Waterloo County. And Waterloo County is around the cities of Kitchener and Waterloo today. The census of 1981 still confirmed the Germans as Canada's third largest ethnic group. Of further interest should be the fact that what is now Ontario was in the year 1788 divided into four districts with German names. They were from east to west, Lunenburg, Mecklenburg, Nassau, and Hesse, which came about by means of a proclamation by Lord Dorchester and in the name of English King George III with his German heritage. It was a thank you to the participation of the German troops on the British side in the war, in the American War of Independence. In fact, often they were called Hessians, as many of them had actually come from Hesse. While after the war, German loyalists started homesteads in the Maritimes, in Quebec along the north shore of the St. Lawrence River, and along the northern shores of Lakes Ontario and Erie, a tremendous contribution to the development of Canada was made by German farmers who opened up the West, which started with the Red River Settlement, that's in Manitoba. It happened under the sponsorship of Lord Selkirk, the governor of the Hudson's Bay Company, and started in 1811. Soon, German-speaking soldiers and settlers from the Alsace and from German-Swiss cantons were brought in to help with the struggle against the intruders of the Northwest Company, which was an opposition company, that saw their trapping rights endangered. The city of Winnipeg evolved from this settlement. In the German-Canadian yearbook in 1992 by Professor Hartmut Furschle, we can read the following excerpt. Lord Dufferin, Governor General of Canada, who visited the new settlement in 1877, expressed enthusiasm in his address in Winnipeg with the following words. Although I have witnessed many sights to give me pleasure during my various progresses through the Dominion, seldom have I beheld any spectacle more pregnant with prophecy, more fraught with promise of an astonishing future than the Mennonite settlements. When I visited these interesting people, they had been here only 2 years in the province, and yet in a long ride I took across the prairies which but yesterday were absolutely bare, desolate, and untenanted, and to the home of the home of the wolf, the badger, and the eagle, I passed village after village, homestead after homestead, furnished with all the conveniences and incidents of European comfort and a scientific agriculture, while on the other side of the road were cornfields already ripe for harvest, and pastures populous with herds of cattle stretching away to the horizon. Even on this continent, this peculiar theater of rapid change and progress, there was nowhere, I imagine, taking place so marvelous a transformation. And that, you know, within a couple of years, the work of German settlers, farmers, mostly Mennonites. When British Columbia joined the new Canadian Confederation in 1871, it was a stipulation that it must be connected to the country's east coast by a railway, a task that was undertaken by the privately owned Canadian Pacific Railway. From that time on, mass migration into the west was promoted by the government, which tried to help this development along with the generous Homesteading Act of 1872 for land-hungry farmers. Of all the new immigrants who were attracted to the vast open regions, those of German ethnicity did not primarily come from Germany proper, but from German settlements in Russia and southeastern Europe. Even before the railway line had reached Winnipeg in 1882, 7,000 Mennonites from the Ukraine put down their roots in about 110 locations in southern Manitoba, where they founded towns like Steinbach, Gretna, Altona, Winkler, and others. The first two German settlers in Alberta were recorded in 1882, and after the German Lutherans from Galicia in 1891 founded Hofnungau and Rosenthal, formerly Stony Plains near Edmonton, a center of Germans from Volhynia, which is I think in modern day Romania, was also established in the same year south of Edmonton. In British Columbia, the first group of German immigrants arrived in 1850, that's 17 years before Confederation, among them Dr. Sebastian Helmkin, who for many years was the only doctor between Alaska and San Francisco. Get that, the only doctor between Alaska and San Francisco. That is a mighty huge territory. Don't forget that places like Seattle and the state of Washington were only settled by whites well into the 19th century. In 1856, Dr. Helmkin, was elected to the first Legislative Assembly in British Columbia and was a delegate to Ottawa in negotiating the entry of his province into Confederation. He also made a unique contribution to the historiography of British Columbia by leaving his reminiscences, five handwritten volumes of rather colorful history, from his own personal perspective. You know, I bet most Canadians didn't know this. As the German immigration into Western Canada was dominated by religious groups, we find a variety of denominations such as the Hutterites, the Anabaptist community, who, like the Mennonites, emerged from the radical wing of the Protestant Reformation. They are mainly found in Manitoba and Alberta, where there are around 17,000 living in isolation from the world on communal farms called Bruderhof, that's the colonies of brethren. They also came from Russia. Another originally German religious community in the vicinity of Edmonton is the Moravian Unitas Fratrum, or the Hamhuter Brudergemeinde. Which organized with the Reformation movement of Johannes Huss in Bohemia in the 15th century. Their name brings to mind two Moravian missionaries, of whom there were many arriving as early as 1784 and serving the Canadian native people. One by the name of Binninger served until 1795 as the first teacher to Loyalist Mohawks. These are Mohawks who fought with the British crown against the American Revolutionaries. Another was David Seisberger In 1791, he, quote, led a tribe of Delaware Indians persecuted for their pacifist attitude by the Americans and subjected to various massacres. And he led them from Ohio to Ontario, where in Kent County they founded a Moravian town, later named Schoenfeld, or Fairfield, by Seisberger. The first Moravian mission station for the Eskimos of Labrador was established in 1752 in Hopenthal, or Hopedale. David Seisberger stood out for some other achievements. He introduced beekeeping into Canada, compiled the Quarto Lingual Dictionary of English, German, Iroquois, Delaware. Imagine, that is a huge feat. Imagine, he compiled the Quarto, I think that's Quattro actually, Lingual Dictionary for English, German, Iroquois, and Delaware. What an immense feat. Just imagine even a simplified English-German dictionary. But add in two Native Indian languages. I bet you didn't know that. If you're a Canadian, I would, you know, I bet not one in a thousand knew that. Even a lot of Canadians of German origin like myself. Why? Because it's suppressed history. Not because it has anything to do with the big H. But what it is the denigration of the German people, the insistence that we not have pride, is very strong. It came from a variety of sources, but has picked up energy since the Second World War, when evil, profoundly evil reptilian people decided they wanted to exterminate the German people. In fact, there was such a book published in 1941 by Frederick Kaufmann. It was called Germany Must Perish. And it was a blueprint for genocide. You know, if it was authored today in Canada, it could actually be prosecuted. Now, not that I believe it should be. I think you should be able to write whatever you want. But it proposed that after the war was over, all Germans, adults, be sterilized. So that Germans would effectively disappear within 50 years, right? Well, then a more modified form of genocide was practiced at the end of the war. 1 million German soldiers who had surrendered, and under Geneva Conventions and the rules of war, they would be considered prisoners of war, POWs, entitled to certain protections and guarantees. Well, Eisenhower, an arch war criminal, played a dirty little bureaucratic trick. They weren't called prisoners of war, and they were herded together in giant camps on the Rhine. Over a million, that's right, 1 million perished from starvation and disease. They were fed almost nothing. There was almost no water. There was no sanitation. And efforts by German civilians to throw food and supplies over the barbed wire were repulsed. In fact, they were told they'd be shot, and some were shot. This was cold-blooded, deliberate starvation and a massacre of surrendered soldiers. If there had been justice, Supreme American U.S. Commander Dwight Eisenhower would have hanged by his neck in Nuremberg, if it had been a just situation. They were listed as other losses, and it was not until the mid-1980s that a fellow Canadian by the name of James Bach came upon this. He was actually researching something else, and he was wondering, what are these other losses? And he broke the story of Eisenhower's camps on the Rhine. Well, that was one way to begin the extermination of the German people. Then, of course, there was the mass expulsion. And then, right at the end of the war, there was the deliberate starvation. Now, there was food. Food was had been sent from North America to war-torn Europe.
People like former U.S. President Herbert Hoover took a major role, played a major role in trying to distribute this food. But he found himself constantly stymied. Finally, the protests reached the American Congress and the deliberate program of starvation was stopped. But not before 1 million German civilians needlessly died. So then the diabolical forces hit upon an even better plan. Yes, the world might recoil if you massacred people in mass, or you sterilized them. But what if you could so demoralize them that many would not have any children? Many would hate themselves, would not want to be called Germans. One of the most offensive moments of my life occurred in the Caribbean, where I was, I met a number of people from Europe, and I said to one fellow, I happened to know his last name, I said, "Oh, you're German." "No, I'm a citizen of Europe." I thought, well, lottie bloody daw for you. Too ashamed to even, acknowledge yourself as German. Well, you know, when you destroy a people psychologically, within a couple of generations, there won't be many of them around anymore. They won't believe in themselves. And that really is one of the most diabolical ways to destroy people. And that's the way the reptilian forces have decided to operate. And so when I challenge people and say, "Well, did you know this about German history?" I don't blame them. I don't blame them for ignorance, because they were never taught. And this sort of amazing contribution to my country of German people, largely unknown. And as a linguist, I'm just blown away by the achievement of this David Seisberger producing a quadrilingual dictionary, English, German, Iroquois, and Delaware. Anyway, continuing Christian Klein's account, as pointed out by Dr. Furschlip of the in the German Canadians, A Concise History, much of the early achievements of German-speaking settlers in this country have been forgotten and have not been properly recorded in the history books. Much more information can be gained from his research, as recorded in this volume he just mentioned, which also details the countless contributions to Canada by groups and individuals who've arrived in the last century, especially after World War II. Here is another tribute, is quoted in the this volume by Dr. Furschler. The English traveler Adam Ferguson, who in 1832 published a book entitled The Tour of Canada, this is published in London, reported on his visit to Waterloo County in 1822. Thus, "We passed through the township of Waterloo, settled mostly by Germans. The soil appeared to be good, useful, sandy loam, well watered by streams and springs. I was delighted with the cultivation, especially upon the farms of Schneider and Warner. Each farm might be 200 to 300 acres laid out into regular fields, and not a stump to be seen. The plowing was capital, the crops luxuriant, and the cattle, horses, barns, etc., and the orchards promising a rich return. Waterloo satisfied me above all that I have seen of the capability, and the results attest to this fact." And finally, a word from the conclusion of Dr. Furschler's book: "German Canadians, as citizens of two worlds, have contributed in large measure to increased understanding between the nations. By their very existence, they have refuted many a media lie. The average Canadian who gets to know his German neighbor as a decent, reliable human being can compare reality with the media stereotype and draw his conclusions. Where would the German export industry be without the opening of foreign markets by emigrants? Furthermore, by their self-discipline and industry, learned at home and handed on to their children, German Canadians have made achieved great things for Canada, making good use of the opportunities offered in the New World. If a viable German ethnic group were to disappear in the not-too-distant future, it would be its native country's loss without becoming Canada's gain." Anyway, a very thoughtful piece, and very informative piece, written by Christian Klein. Very glad to read this on my show, as I promised I'd do. And
gives us a little bit of a jolt, knowing how badly we are served by our lamestream media. Well, I'm going to take a short musical break here, and consistent with celebrating Dominion Day, I'm going to play a couple of songs by Stompin' Tom Connors. Now, Stompin' Tom passed away in March of 2013, actually within a few days of another great Canadian, Doug Christie, the great free speech lawyer. Stompin' Tom was born Tom Connors. He grew up in the Maritimes. He went traveled across the Dominion a number of times doing various jobs, including one made famous in one of his songs, tobacco picking in Tilsonburg, Ontario. And along the way, he became a musician, a very gifted songwriter and singer. And his songs celebrate Canada and Canadians, the land and the people, in a very down-home, non-boastful sort of patriotism. The patriotism of celebrating real people in tune with the land, not conquests of other countries and putting a beating on somebody else. He was got the tag Stompin' Tom Connors from a habit he had when he performed of keeping time with the music or stomping with his foot. And it got to the point where he would often bring up a piece of a square of plywood out to the stage, on stage, and by the end of his show for the night, had often stomped his way through it. Well, this is Stompin' Tom Connors, and this is called Canada Day, Up Canada Way.
We all know and love. His songs are snapshots of our lives.
Pour poursuivre le spectacle dans l'esprit de fierté nationale qu'on sent presque tangible depuis le début de la soirée, accueillons un chanteur canadien pur d'âme, véritable barde de l'âme du pays.
With his tribute to Canada Day, please welcome a proud Canadian Stompin' Tom Connors.
Yes, Canada Day, up Canada Way.
Here's another Dominion Day song by Stompin' Tom, C-A-N-A-D-A.
C-A-N-A-D-A. Tell me, what's a Douglas fir? C-A-N-A-D-A. Bet you never heard a bobcat purr. C-A-N-A-D-A. Have you ever seen a lobster crawl? In Canada, we get to see them all. We get to see the maple trees, maple sugar and the maple leaves. We get the biggest wheat fields growing tall. In C-A-N-A-D-A, where we see the reversing falls, in Canada, we get to see them all. C-A-N-A-D-A, tell me, what's a tidal bore? C-A-N-A-D-A, have you ever heard the ocean roar? C-A-N-A-D-A, just listen to that wild goose call. In Canada, we get to see them all. We get to see the maple trees, maple sugar and the maple leaves. We get the biggest timber woods so tall. In C-A-N-A-D-A, where adventure ever calls. In Canada, we get to see them all. C-A-N-A-D-A, have you ever heard of Maple Creek? C-A-N-A-D-A, bet you never seen a mountain peak. C-A-N-A-D-A, in the land of the big snowball, in Canada, we get to see them all. We get to see the maple trees, maple sugar and the maple leaves. We got the biggest wheat fields growing far. In C-A-N-A-D-A, where we see the reversing falls, in Canada, we get to see them all. C-A-N-A-D-A, have you ever seen a magnetic elf? C-A-N-A-D-A, or a lady on a dollar bill? C-A-N-A-D-A, bet you never seen the autumn fall. In Canada, we get to see them all. We get to see the maple trees, maple sugar and the maple leaves. We got the biggest timber woods so tall. In C-A-N-A-D-A, where adventure ever calls. In Canada, we get to see them all. I say in Canada, we get to see them all.
Stompin' Tom and Canada, C-A-N-A-D-A. And I'm going to conclude this with a song of my stomping grounds, and it reflects his experiences traveling across the country and meeting Canadians. And it's a really upbeat sort of
song that
patriotism.
I had a little help with the idea of this song. A fellow Newfoundlander, by the way, a fellow by the name of Roy Payne, gave me the idea to write this here song. And with his idea and with a little bit of my lyrics and a tune, we come up with a number, and it's called My Stomping Grounds. If you'll abide with me on this one, it's true as I feel it. I guess it's in the gear D, boys. I've been all across this country, from the East Coast to the West. And I've been asked about 1,000 times what places I like best. Well, I've had to base my answers on the friendly people I've found. And if you're inclined to take the time, this is where you'll find my stomping grounds. Just take a little piece of PEI, old Saskatchewan, Nova Scotia, and New Brunswick, way back in Newfoundland, Alberta and Manitoba, Ontario and BC, and you'll have found the stomping grounds of all my friends and me. You'll have found the stomping grounds of all my friends and me. You know, there was a time of a buddy of mine when a freight train was our abode. We found people in this here land that would help a guy along the road. Some of them lived in a country, and others lived in town. But these are the people that made me proud to say this is my stomping ground. Just take a little piece of PEI, old Saskatchewan, Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, way back in Newfoundland, Alberta and Manitoba, Ontario and BC, and you'll have found the stomping grounds of all my friends and me. You'll have found the stomping grounds of all heard my answer. That's one I hope you'll understand. It's just my way of kind of saying thank you to the people of this land. And it doesn't matter really where you're from, you can spread the word around. Wherever you find a heart that's kind, you're in a part of my stomping ground. Just take a little piece of PI, paddle Saskatchewan, Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, Quebec and Newfoundland, Alberta and Manitoba, Ontario and BC, and you'll have found the stomping grounds of all my friends and me. And you'll have found the stomping grounds of all my friends and me.
That's Stomp of Tom Connors and My Stomping Grounds. Sort of a very, I think, positive form of patriotism. What was I seeing here? Oh, yes! I can't believe this. This is from the United States. I'm going to read most of this story. I must say, I cannot believe it. Woman who sent texts urging suicide, guilty. Michelle Carter, convicted of involuntary manslaughter for causing boyfriend's death. I thought there was a concept in law called mens rea. I mean, you have to have a crime in mind. How can you involuntarily do something? Okay, well, let's see what this is all about. Taunton, Massachusetts. A woman who sent her boyfriend a barrage of text messages urging him to kill himself when they were both teenagers, was convicted Friday of involuntary manslaughter in a trial that raised questions about whether words can kill. The judge found Michelle Carter caused the death of Conrad Roy III, who intentionally filled his truck with carbon monoxide in a Fairhaven, Massachusetts store parking lot in 2014. Let's focus on that word, intentionally. So this dumb bunny fills his pickup truck with carbon monoxide and kills himself. He killed himself, not her. No. It is perhaps a little more complicated. All right. Carter, who faces up to 20 years in prison, cried and clutched a handkerchief to her face as juvenile court judge Lawrence Moniz detailed her conduct and the circumstances of Roy's death. But she was stoic when the verdict was formally pronounced. As spectators and members of both the Roy and Carter families left the courtroom, she sat at the defense table sobbing while her lawyers tried to comfort her. The judge focused his ruling on the words Carter said to the 18-year-old Roy after he climbed out of the truck as it was filling with toxic carbon monoxide, and told her he was scared. Get back in, Carter told Roy, according to a friend who testified that she had seen the texted conversation about a month after Roy died. The judge said those words constitute wanton and reckless conduct. Stupid comments, yeah. Did she make this unstable guy kill himself? Well, no. She didn't drag him into a truck and handcuff him to the wheel and fill it up with... You know, we are in complete retreat from individual responsibility. Well, you know, what your mother used to say when you said, well, my friend told me to do it. You know, and I've heard my mother say, and you probably heard your mother or father say much the same thing, well, if your friend told you to jump over the cliff, would you? It's a rhetorical question, and the answer was presumed to be no. No, I wouldn't. Well, so she's the girlfriend, and she's got to be very young. She was 16 at the time. The judge said those words constituted wanton and reckless conduct. He said Carter, then 17, no, she was 17, and that's back in, 2014. So she's only 20 now. He said Carter, who then 17, had a duty to call someone to help
when she knew Roy was attempting suicide. Yet she did not call the police or Roy's family, he noted. She did not issue a simple additional instruction. Get out of the truck, the judge said. Well, the guy is older than she is. I mean, I agree her conduct is reprehensible, unwise, maybe hormone-driven, but criminal? It's a weird old world, isn't it? The case provided a disturbing look at teen depression and suicide. Carter and Roy met in Florida in 2012 while both of them were vacationing with their families. Their relationship consisted mainly of texting and other electronic communications. They met in person a handful of times, so it sounds more like an internet relationship. Both teens struggled with depression. Carter had been treated, that's the girl, for anorexia, and Roy had made earlier suicide attempts. Now, you know, is she responsible for the guy who's a screwball? I don't know. What is it? I think I, and probably you come out of a religious and moral world where you got to take individual responsibility. If you are so weak as to want to off yourself, and somebody, your girlfriend, I'm not even sure she was his girlfriend, but a friend says, oh, go for it, or go do it. I mean, if you're that mentally weak, you say, well, okay, I guess I will. I mean, frankly, from an evolutionary point of view, you're not fit to live, are you? And my guess is if he didn't off himself at this point, he was going to do it some other time because he'd already tried it a few times. The sensational trial was closely watched in legal circles and a hot topic on social media, in part because of the insistent tone of text messages Carter sent to Roy. You can't think about it. You just have to do it. You said you were going to do it. Don't get why you aren't. Carter wrote to Roy the day of his suicide. I thought you wanted to do this. The time is right, and you're ready. Just do it, babe. She wrote in another text that day. Now, she may be a hard-hearted bitch. I don't know. But come on! The guy is an adult. Weak as he might be, he's an adult. And somebody says, prove you're a man by killing yourself. Well, if he's that dumb to do it, frankly, I don't think he deserves to live. Maybe she did the gene pool a service by removing something clearly defective. Come on, I mean, if somebody keeps egging you on to commit suicide, but you're the one who in the end, well, stays in the cab of this truck that was filling up with carbon monoxide. Carter's lawyer, Joseph Cataldo, argued that Roy was determined to kill himself and nothing Carter did to change that. He said Roy initially tried to talk Roy out, Carter tried to talk Roy out of it and urged him to get professional help, but eventually went along with his plan. Another possible interpretation is if you goad somebody, you perhaps make them face the reality of what they're doing. If she says, well, come on, you said you were going to commit suicide, well, go ahead and do it. And then they have to really think, oh, you would hope, well, maybe this isn't such a good idea. Roy's father said the family was pleased with the conviction. The American Civil Liberties Union denounced the conviction, saying it exceeds the limits of our criminal laws and violates free speech protections. I think it also violates common sense. And while I find myself in the unusual position of agreeing with the American Civil Liberties Union, that there's also the wider concern. A person must be responsible for their own actions. You can't say the devil made me do it, or, well, she told me to commit suicide. Well, yeah, she might have told you to, but do you have to do it? It might be different if she gave him bad advice, misleading advice. If she had said, for instance, oh, you won't really be dead. That's lying to somebody. But to have egged him on, while I think it's extremely reprehensible behavior, disgusting behavior, wrong behavior, I can't see how it rises to criminal. It'll be interesting to see what happens at the sentencing. Apparently, this was in juvenile court, so you would think they're going to probably go easy on her. And it really is groundbreaking. She didn't mislead him. It appears he was a weak, suicide-prone individual. It's not even clear that they were girlfriend, boyfriend, or lovers. Certainly not a very loving thing to do, urging him to commit suicide. But I think there's a chasm between stupid, even immoral and wrong behavior, and a jail sentence. And hopefully this will get appealed. What concerns me most, though, is the retreat from individual responsibility. Nobody forced that misguided lad into the truck, or made him fill it up with carbon monoxide, or when all this had happened, stay in that truck until he died. He chose that. A stupid choice, of course, but his choice. And I it seems wrong to somehow put the blame on her. Or when she told him to do it, she may well have done. And that didn't seem to be in question. But in the end, it was his choice to kill himself. And as it already appeared in testimony, this is not the first time he tried. Well, okay, this time he succeeded. Is it the role of society to save somebody from their folly? I don't think it is. What ought to be impressed upon people at all levels is the importance of taking responsibility for themselves. But you know, that goes along with a sad trend in our society, which is we want somebody else to take care of us. Well, somebody else may try, and you know what happens when you get somebody else to take care of you? You lose your freedom. Well, this is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on WhiteResistanceRadio.com. Back with you again tomorrow, same time, midnight Eastern Time. These are all Eastern Standard Time. Shows repeated at 8 in the morning and 4 in the afternoon. And I sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, the Maple Leaf Forever. And you've heard a little bit about that earlier in the show.